Hello and welcome to the i3 podcast. My name is Wouter Klein and I'm the Director of Content for the Investment Innovation Institute. For more information about our educational forums for institutional investors, please visit our website at www.i3-invest.com. There you can also subscribe to our complimentary newsletter, i3 Insights, in which we discuss investment strategy and asset allocation questions with asset owners around the world. Now, as you all know, we love our disclaimers in this industry, so here's ours. This recording is for educational purposes only. It does not constitute financial advice. Please enjoy the show. Welcome to the i3 podcast. I'm here today with Felicity Walsh, who is the Managing Director and Head of Australia and New Zealand for Franklin Templeton. Felicity, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Wouter, and i3.
So today we're going to look a little bit about leadership, slightly different from our normal investment-focused podcast, but we basically want to get a bit of a sense of how you run the business, how you foster culture, and also how you sort of motivate your staff and mentoring as well. But before we do that, we want to get a bit of a sense of your background. And I think before you started in the investment industry, you actually by training are both an actuary and a chemist, or chemistry you studied. So how come the actuarial side won over chemistry?
Yeah, Ruta, it's an interesting question because I don't think it was entirely well planned. But look, I just always loved maths and science. And in the UK back then, 20 odd years ago, you've studied A-levels. And I chose maths, physics, chemistry as my A-levels. And so I was always going to go into maths or the sciences. But I loved the lab work of chemistry. I loved the variety that you got within chemistry, all the different elements within chemistry. And so I decided to study chemistry over maths at university. I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I also hadn't realised that I'd picked one of the courses with the most hours because it was lab work most afternoons on top of lectures every morning. So by the end of 3 years, I was pretty much done with the lab coat and safety specs and chose to change tact a little bit. So I undertook an internship at what was then Watson Wyatt. And it was in the actuarial team, in the benefits team, and I just really loved the office vibe. I loved the variety of the work. I loved the young culture in the office. And that was it, really. I moved on to get a grad role with Watson Wyatt back in 2003 and really thoroughly enjoyed my actuarial training. It's 5 years or so of training whilst working. And I think it's one of the things that really has set me up for the future that I didn't realize at the time. I was just doing it because I enjoyed it. I liked the work. I liked the challenge of it. I liked my team. But some of the skills you learnt, or rather I learnt, whilst trying to juggle being in your 20s, full-time work, full-time study on top of your work, some of those skills around multitasking, prioritization, being able to really deal with stress and a lot of pressure, particularly at certain points in the year, I think have been really big contributors to how I've kind of developed over the last 20 years. But probably I didn't quite recognise it at the time. So I'm forever grateful for sticking it out and doing the actuarial training. And I'm always a huge advocate, whether it's people that we're hiring into our team or just more broadly of people studying after formal qualifications are finished. I just think it gives another dimension of being able to do both at once, working and studying. And then, so actuarial work, I really enjoyed the work. I was in the UK doing actuarial work for 10 years. The work changed a lot over that time. We can come on to that a little bit later. But clearly in the middle of that 10-year period was the GFC. So that created a whole different dynamic. And I kind of started getting myself into more of the corporate work. So a lot of actuarial work in the UK is based on, you know, working with the trustees and their defined benefit plans. Post GFC, the system really switched. These defined benefit plans had these enormous deficits, and the corporate suddenly had to deal with them. The regulator had come in and said, you've got to plug these holes of these enormous deficits. So there was a lot of structuring that went on around how to diminish or how to kind of offload liabilities into other parts of the market. And as part of that, there was a process of trying to win new clients. And I always really, I got stuck into that, and I always enjoyed that part of the work. And at the time, again, I guess I didn't realise that later in my career journey, that would be really important kind of foundation work.
You spent about a decade at Watson Wyatt, and then that became Towers Watson. You just mentioned as well sort of the defined contribution system as opposed to what we have here with the defined benefit. What are some of the key changes between the markets you saw in the UK and here, other than sort of just the DC-DB system?
Yeah, well, this is going back 10 years. I've been in Australia 10 years, so my comments are applicable at that kind of time. But it was a really fascinating shift. So when I moved to Australia, I moved into the investment team, and predominantly because of that DBDC environment. So I remember Graham Miller at the time, who was heading up the investment team at Towers Watson in Australia. He had an actuarial background as well, and he said, Felicity, you'll be pretty bored in benefits. There's not much to the DB market in Australia. Advise you transition into the investment side. So that's what I did. So really, that switch from actuarial to investment was really due to the difference in the two markets. But there were some really interesting observations that you don't really recognize until you get stuck in. I guess the first one, though, is maybe it sounds obvious, but it's just the size. So in the UK, my largest client was one of the largest funds. It was an amalgamation of two banks that had gone through a bit of a period during the GFC, and they had one of the largest DB funds in the UK. And I was fortunate enough to work on that account. But the assets of that fund were about 5 billion UK pounds. So at the time, about, you know, kind of 10 billion Aussie, which to us just seems such a tiny number, but that was a really huge number. A lot of the funds we worked on over there were in the hundreds of millions, not in the billions. So I think just even back then, when there were a lot more smaller funds in Australia, still the whole scale and I guess the concentration in comparison to the much more fragmented market in the UK was pretty significant. And of course, that's just, you know, that's just continued.
So it's very different than sort of the Dutch market, where you also have a defined benefit system, but it's basically ABP, there's PGGM, and that's pretty much it. The rest is all tiny.
Yes. So lots of smaller, you know, USO, you know, parents, smaller corporate plans, I guess you'd describe them as here. I think there's been, you know, a lot more kind of consolidation since. And of course, there's the big public sector, university schemes, etc. But yeah, the corporate plans kind of dominated. And that's where a lot of the more interesting work was as well, because there was that kind of pressure between the UK parent and the US parent and the regulatory requirements within the UK, which, you know, which caused some interesting dynamics. But a few other observations, which are perhaps not things you might think of, but I guess the difference between thinking about growth and thinking about kind of defensive assets. So in the UK, a lot of the work was focused around the fixed income and the bonds, a lot of matching of the liabilities to specific bonds, like very intricate work around using different fixed income instruments to match the liabilities of the DB funds. In Australia, there was just so much focus on the growth portfolio, so a much bigger focus on equity part of the portfolio and other growth assets. And in particular in fixed income, I remember asking my boss once, like, what about inflation-linked bonds? Why aren't we suggesting inflation-linked bonds? And I think he thought I was a bit mad. I just hadn't appreciated that there was no depth to that market in Australia. So, you know, the huge difference in the bond market, I think, was another thing. And I guess this links into another observation, but was the lack of focus on retirement. So in the UK at that time, you had to annuitise once you got to retirement. And of course, in the DB plan, the annuitisation is built in. It took me a while to get my head around the fact that you could get up to 65, 66 retirement age here and just take the whole lot as a...
And that's it, there's no strategy afterwards.
And that's it, and you can
pay off the mortgage.
Go and buy a boat and go on, you know, 15 cruises. And there was just, that was okay. I mean, in the UK, you could take up to a kind of a quarter of that pod as cash, but, you know, that was a, you know, a lot of people didn't take even that. That was kind of a bit risky. So I think that just different kind of mentality of what is this pool of assets for? And of course, now with the retirement income covenant and focus more on the retirement phase, you can kind of see the two kind of coming together a little bit.
It's a hard problem to solve, though, I think, with the defined contribution system, because as you said, in DB, there's sort of a built-in annuity. It's been spread out over a pool of members for pretty much the entire duration of the fund. And here you got the defined contribution, and then suddenly you need to have something that looks maybe a little bit like a defined benefit. But how do you pull people after a life of savings?
Yeah, and I think it's when I've tried to kind of think about this just myself, it's almost just the starting point is so different, and it's the wrong way around. It's very hard. So in the UK, we were moving from DB to DC, and we were doing that incrementally in a lot of ways. So an intermediate step was to go to a kind of career average fund. So instead of taking a final salary calculation, you'd take a calculation of salary across the life of the individual and some other differences in accrual rates, etc. So kind of bringing down the emphasis on DB, but not quite getting as far as it being, you know, fully DC and really fully member dependent. Whereas here, you're going from members having all the choice and members having no lock-ins as to what they have to do once they get to that retirement point. So trying to add things that create, you know, boundaries or rules is much, much harder than to take things away, which was kind of what we were doing in the UK. So yeah, quite the opposite end of the spectrum.
Although you see also some of the European countries now moving more to a DC system because DB seems to have become too expensive. I think when I grew up, I heard members retiring at like 70% of their last earned wage for the rest of their life. Like, it sounds good, but it's quite expensive too.
Exactly. And that was one of the key reasons why I think the work was so interesting in the UK in those last 5 years I was there, because it was very much focused on how to de-risk these defined benefit funds, so longevity hedging or buyouts of certain types of pensioners or deferred pensioners, and really trying to think a lot more about it from the financial perspective of the corporate opposed to the member.
When you came to Australia, you worked as an investment consultant for a while at Towers Watson, but then at one point you joined K2, which is a US-based fund of hedge funds, which is quite a different thing to do. What did you? Why did you make that decision?
Yeah, Ruta, it was a little bit different, but actually it sounds more different than it was in reality. The reality was that it was hedge fund to fund advisory business. So it was a very consultative business, constructed portfolios of different hedge funds, and they had a decent footprint in the Australian institutional market. So the clients were actually very similar clients to the clients that I was consulting to at Towers, but that was on a whole of portfolio approach rather than just in one specific asset class. So although it was quite a departure in terms of a really small team, so just four of us in Australia, much smaller overall business and a very specific asset class, the actual clients were consistent. And the kind of approach to dealing with clients was obviously entirely within my wheelhouse. I do remember ringing my mum and when I was walking down the street and telling her about this role, and she was very against it. She thought it was far too risky, and you know, why would I move to this small firm and you know, New York and hedge funds, and those were all words that weren't very familiar. But anyway, I don't know, something in me just decided to take the plunge. I'm so thrilled that I did. I absolutely loved K2. For me, it was learning a whole new asset class. Each of the underlying different strategies within the hedge fund universe, learning about all of them, then learning about all of the managers within each of those segments was absolutely fascinating. It was a huge learning experience, but every new manager that would come through Sydney, we'd talk to them, we'd figure out whether they'd have something that might be additive to our portfolios and our institutional clients in Australia. And it was just an incredible learning experience. And of course, the other part of it was the US-based company. So with it came a lot of travel to the US and to London as well. So either with our clients here, visiting the managers in those locations, or just really getting to grips with the industry. So a lot of that Connecticut in just north of New York is where we were based, and that's where a lot of the hedge funds were traditionally based. So it was a really fantastic role, incredible amounts of learning, but this consistency with my clients, who I'd started to develop good relationships with during my Towers Watson days, made it a pretty seamless transition. But you were very much plonked in and figure it out. It wasn't like my lovely actuarial training where it was a very, you know, very structured progression. Yeah. It was figure it out and get on with it.
I imagine that would be quite daunting because, you know, hedge funds, it's quite a diverse industry with lots of different strategies, lots of different approaches. Yeah, it's kind of sink or swim, I can imagine.
Absolutely. And I think the jargon was one of the key things. And I remember I always kept this Word document that I'd be sitting in meetings and I'd hear words and I'd just write them down, and I'd go back and I'd Google them. And thank God for Google that you can just, you know, you can just, Investopedia gives you a pretty quick answer on what that word means and it kind of falls into place. But there was just so much, I mean, it probably could have been made a lot simpler, but there was just a lot to it that coming as quite an outsider to that world that you just had to get your head around. But that was what was great about the role. It was...
So you basically made your own glossary of hedge fund terms?
100%. I've still got it somewhere. It was... And I would refer back to it years in. I just had to, yeah, kind of try and get my head around what they were talking about, and then to try and not use that jargon then when I was with clients, because that would be, you know, doubly... confusing. So that was that was part of the fun of K2.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. My background is in financial journalism, and I did exactly the same. I made glossaries of terms because basically I had to get around a lot of different topics. And I always say that journalists know very little about a lot of different things, and that's how I kept track of things, just, you know, having a glossary there. But at the time when you joined K2, I think it was already part of the Franklin Templeton business. K2 was acquired in 2012. What made you decide to move over to the Franklin Templeton business?
Yeah, look, Wouter, so you're absolutely right. So when I joined K2, it was already part of FT. However, at the time, FT's acquisition strategy at that point was to take smaller stakes in businesses that they didn't already have presence in. So K2 was one of its earlier acquisitions, in fact, first acquisition in the alternative space. But because of that model, we were kept very separate. So yes, we were part of this huge machine of Franklin Templeton, but even in the office, which is still my current office today at 88 Phillip, we had a different half of the floor. We had our own fridge. We had our own clock with the time zones. We had our own TV. We didn't quite have our own entrance, but we were very much a franchise of, you know, that much bigger business, but we didn't have a huge amount of overlap with the business. So we were left to do what we needed to do with our institutional clients and accounts. And we'd overlap with the broader firm at times, but it was pretty separate. I guess over the years, that changed. And one of the reasons it changed was partly because of our clients. So one of our clients, a large super fund, I recall, you know, they were looking at regions rather than specific asset classes. And they were doing a project on emerging markets. And they had done this huge analysis and picked out a couple of specific countries, India and Brazil, actually, at the time. And they wanted to know more about what were the investment opportunities in alternatives in those countries. So it could have been in hedge funds, or it could have been something broader. Ended up that it did end up being something broader. It was actually a renewable. It ended up being something in renewables. But I think that started me kind of weaving myself through the business a little bit, trying to find out what else there was within FT. And I guess that just kind of continued. Over time, then, as the stakes got brought out, K2 was brought closer into FT. FT then began buying more businesses. And in this case, there'd be wholly owned businesses. So a different model. So there wasn't this kind of segregation that we had in the early days of K2. And I guess in a way, then, it was a natural progression for me to move across to look after the institutional business for FT in Australia. So still continuing in the role at K2 and looking after that part of the business and my small team there, but also taking on the responsibility of the broader institutional relationships. I think another part of that was me seeing what was going on in the market. So hedge fund of funds had been a successful, you know, that's been a successful strategy for the institutions in Australia. They were still finding their feet in hedge funds, for example, and they needed that extra layer of assistance from an advisory firm like K2. But clearly, as fees got more pressurized, as teams got larger, market conditions and equities doing really well, diversification becoming a little bit less of a factor, I think that was also something that I'd kind of recognized, and it was probably going to be pretty limiting to just stay in that part of the world for too much longer. So yeah, when the opportunity arose to look after the broader institutional business, I was pretty quick to jump on that.
So you're now leading the company's efforts in the Australasian region. Can you describe a little bit to me, like, what is your leadership style? Are you, you know, collaborative? Do you have sort of a plan for the next 5 years? How do you approach it?
I guess I've always come from very respectful businesses. And I think my training through Towers has clearly had a huge impact on how I now think about leadership. I'm very keen on a flat structure. So a lack of hierarchy, which is perhaps a little bit different to how a lot of fund management and particularly global businesses operate. I am a big proponent of making efficient decisions and making decisions pretty quickly. When you have lots of heads of or lots of layers, that decision-making efficiency can get quite lost. And I think if you've got really quality people that are good decision makers, you don't necessarily need lots and lots of them to make effective decisions. This clearly causes some issues because, you know, we're a relatively small team here in Australia. So there's about 60 in my direct team. You know, that does create some issues around career progression. And if you don't have a really structured, what's my next job title, what's my next role, then that can be tricky for retention. So I think it's really important to be able to balance that by ensuring that people are not too focused on what's the job title or where you sit in the kind of pecking order. It's about, are you getting exposure to really interesting new areas of work, different clients? Are you getting the opportunity to, you know, travel overseas, visit our offices overseas, go to different conferences, present at conferences, be part of the industry in other ways, and keep the job really varied and interesting, and that be the driver rather than the driver being around what is the next kind of the next role. And I think maybe that was also a bit my mantra. I never really knew or never really planned it too well. I just kind of kept working really hard and doing all the things that I thought were the right things to do to be put in a position that you would then kind of progress as and when something, you know, fell into place, which is often the case.
Is there a bit of cyclicality in that as well, that, you know, when people start out, they're very focused on their next career move, the next step, but once they get to a certain stage where they think more about, well, what is it actually that I'm doing? Am I, you know, motivated? Am I challenged in my current role? Is there a bit of a cyclicality when it comes to career progression?
I think so, definitely. And it's confidence. I think some of that earlier in your career, particularly if you've worked really hard for it, you place a lot of value on demonstrating that progression. I guess it's, you know, it applies to broader parts of life and progression through life. You know, the next kind of milestones and those next steps. But I do think as you get more mature in your career, yes, absolutely, it becomes more about where am I adding value, knowing the worth of your value and your addition to the business outside of a kind of naming convention or something like that. So yes, I do think that, and you do see it at the younger, the more junior levels through the team, that there's more push for progression than perhaps I was used to or saw, you know, 20 years ago in the early parts of my career, which is not a bad thing. You know, you want to be ambitious, and I always want to take on people within the team who have got great ambition. But it's just about kind of getting the mental kind of, you know, mentally around what the ambition is channeled for and where it's going, I guess.
Yeah, and I think it also comes back to what you mentioned earlier, when you were sort of in your earlier stages of your career, where the importance of learning and continuing to learn on the job and in the industry. I think probably some of the most interesting people are the ones that, you know, they're always trying to learn new things. So I did a couple of weeks ago an interview with Damian Maloney, who's deputy CIO of Australian Super. And he's a very interesting guy, because the first 20 minutes of the interview, he just asked me questions and he just interviewed me. And then he was like, okay, I think I've had a picture now, and now we start the interview. So to even at that level, he's just super curious. And I think that's really important in sort of, especially the later part of your career.
I couldn't agree more, Ruta. It's one of the absolute key things I look for when I'm looking to add to our team. I think having an interest, and it doesn't really matter what particular, you know, what particular part of the industry it is, but just having this desire to learn more about the industry, the more about the people within the industry, and learning new technical skills is, you know, some people just that really drives, you know, that mental stimulation is really excellent. And I think it's something that I've always focused on. So when I came to Australia, for example, I didn't know anyone in the industry here. I was moving with a firm I worked with, but I didn't know people. And so I remember, you know, asking around, what do I do? And, you know, the IMCA SEMA course came up, and it was a pretty broad kind of course on asset allocation. But I thought, well, that'll at least get me, you know, I'll get to grips with some of the legal frameworks, get to grips with the market, meet some people. It was a one-week residential course, as well as some other bits and pieces. And I remember being on that course, and, you know, it wasn't a complex technical course, but it was really about kind of integrating into the market. And some of the people I met on that course, they're in all sorts of fantastic roles around the industry now, but still keep well connected to those people. And I think just, you know, putting that emphasis on pushing yourself a little bit. And I think it's something I look for when I'm hiring, as I mentioned. And, you know, a couple of more junior team members, for example, in my team, they've got their CFA qualifications, their BDMs, working in like traditional sales roles. I think it's really important that their educational, you know, level is really high. And it's something, you know, I place a lot of emphasis on. So really, really supportive of additional study and time off for exams, etc. And not only that, we just hired someone recently in the institutional team in Melbourne. And, you know, she's on the board of Women in Super. That kind of commitment to our industry. I hired someone else in Melbourne recently. She is the chair of Kaya now in Australia. So again, a real commitment to learning in our industry, I think, is incredibly important. And I think it can help kind of bring up the level of the, you know, the quality of the team. I think it's...
So do you have sort of a clear idea of the culture you're trying to foster? Obviously, learning is very important in that. But sometimes, you know, culture is described as it's just the way we do things here. But I think it can be defined a lot more clearly than just, you know, something that grows naturally out of what you're doing every day. Do you have sort of an idea of what you're trying to foster there?
Yeah, look, culture is incredibly interesting, particularly when you work for a global organization, because in a way you're trying to create a subculture within your particular team. But you've obviously got to be cognizant of the broader culture globally. So that's always a challenge when working for a global. But look, the way that I think of, you know, how I want us to work as a team, and how I think what should define us as a team, and, you know, I say this to the team regularly, but I'd really like us to be that team that people look to and know that there's strength and camaraderie throughout the team, but it's a team that others want to be part of. And I think to get to that point, there's got to be a huge amount of respect amongst the team to be able to demonstrate true collaboration and to be able to demonstrate that to the outside world, and people to be able to recognise it and latch onto it, I think is something that I really aspire our team to be. So, you know, quite straightforward example within the sales team, for example, historically you'd have a salesperson attached to a particular account. We really try and have multiple people within the team looking after accounts. That enables the client, which has got, you know, which are getting ever larger, but it enables there to be more touch points. It enables us to demonstrate the quality and the depth of our team outside of just one point person or one kind of key figure. So that's a really important thing that we're always working on, and it can be tricky because there's egos and, you know, people kind of trip over themselves a little bit, but really trying to foster that goal of the success of our business is the success of everyone, and not, you know, trying to get it to too finer a point and kind of and force individuals to play part of that team. I think a good example of how that works well and how it, you know, how it just makes total sense is within, if you think about consultants or researchers, they're key influencers across all segments really of the Australian market. So, you know, the salespeople need to work really well with those people that are managing those relationships with the researchers and consultants and tie in. You couldn't do either one without the other and get a successful result. So I think that's a really easy demonstration, and you can show that in stats, which people like to be able to see stats to kind of justify the outcomes. So I think that's really important. I think the other thing around culture is, and when I look at where I've worked, where there have been good cultures, I think it's just a lot of you follow what your leaders are instilling in the team. So I don't try and think too hard about that. I just think about what do I do and what would I like, you know, people to follow. It's an absolute commitment to our business, a commitment to our clients, a commitment to understanding our industry, a commitment to networking, commitment to understanding people in our industry. And just lots of little things that all combine together that create, I hope, a really robust, intellectually rigorous and collegiate group that actually want to all come together and achieve the same goal for our clients.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier on as well sort of the efficiency of decision making. And I think sort of speaking with a lot of people and having worked for both large and small companies, I think sometimes the best managers are the people that, you know, try to keep the distractions to a minimum and let people focus on their jobs and basically sometimes even shelter them from, you know, outside, especially distractions. What is your view on that?
Wouter, well, look, working for Franklin Templeton, where we tend to acquire new businesses pretty much every 6 months or so, which brings with it incredible amounts of change. And actually, I do want to chat about change. There's an incredible amount of distractions, and you could get completely lost in the distractions of the corporate, which in a lot of cases, in the near term at least, are not, you know, do not make difference to our clients and what we're doing with our clients. So there is a huge element of my role in ensuring that those distractions are not, you know, distractions for the whole team. Clearly, it's a very careful balance because it's not about, you know, need to know basis. It's just about maintaining people's focus and things that they do not need to get distracted with that are not additive to the clients or their roles, that doesn't get in the way. So, yeah, there's a lot of that. I guess what's critical for me as a leader is articulating and giving comfort to the team that they are fully informed about things that are really important to our team and really important to our clients. And all of those things will absolutely be filtered throughout the team, but some of the noise will hopefully just get cut out without yeah, spending time on it.
Fair enough. I want to talk a little bit about the role of mentoring as well. Do you try to incorporate that in the way you run the business? And did you have yourself mentors through the years that were sort of instrumental in where you ended up?
Yeah, mentors is a really interesting one. I think mentors are tricky when they're too organized or coordinated. I think organic mentors that perhaps weren't really intended to be mentors are the best ones, or that's certainly what I've found. And probably if I'd have thought about when I first met them, without naming names, but there's a couple in the market here who I met through Towers Watson early when I moved to Australia, that I will regularly go to for advice or counsel on certain things. But they absolutely would not be people who I would have expected to become mentors. So I think organic mentorship is the best form. I think, though, we need to put a bit more effort in as corporates than that. So at FT, we run an internal mentoring program. We try and pick, up-and-comers within the team, and we pair them with someone in quite a different part of the team. So it might be someone that's running the fixed income portfolios with someone who's in the digital marketing team, for example. So we try and match people that have got really, really different backgrounds. I've been part of that program for 3 or 4 years now, and had some incredible insights from the mentors that I've worked with. The only problem is they then continue, so you kind of create a big band of them as time goes on. And look, some of them don't really work. Sometimes it doesn't gel, and sometimes it feels too formulaic and too forced, and there's just not a natural alignment. I think for it to work really well, there's got to be a real open-mindedness on both sides, and the ability to be quite vulnerable with each other and take out the kind of, who's doing this role and who's doing that role. And I think that's where I've kind of fallen with mentorship, that it's got to be a lot more seen as a peer-to-peer type discussion. But yeah, hugely important. I guess latterly, I've started doing more broader business networking with individuals in similar kind of roles, so from across different industries. I've personally found that incredibly helpful from a mentorship basis, because the insights that people have from retail, entrepreneurs starting their own businesses and building them has been incredibly helpful to tackling, because everyone's tackling the same problems when they're leading teams. There's all the same kind of issues come up. So trying to get those insights from people outside of the finance sphere, which is where, most of my network has resided, has been incredibly helpful. So that's something that I'm always trying to encourage our team to do as well. So different members within the team to make sure that they're networking out there and going to conferences to make connections with people that are in completely different industries, because I think that could be, is hugely beneficial to their networks and to, ultimately to our business.
So what's the philosophy by teaming them up with a different asset class specialist to their own?
Yeah, I guess to try and give a different perspective, and I think to take away some of that feeling of alienation between, different roles. We can be quite segregated in our industry. We can kind of silo people into asset classes or silo people into different roles. And you see that a lot even with recruitment. Or people that get put forward for roles, they've done a very similar role for many years, whereas I'm a real believer in it's about the skills that you pick up along the way. And if you've got the right mindset, then you can easily, you can be fluid across whether it's different segments or different roles within the industry or even within different industries. So I think the aim there is really to try and, help broaden the mindset and not think too narrowly about, just because you do, you're in client services, therefore you should be mentored by someone in client services. In fact, it's more the opposite, to kind of get that broader view.
Yeah, good. I want to talk a little bit about some of the changes we've seen in the industry overall in recent years. So there's a lot of changes taking place with the consolidation of the super funds at one end. We've seen the rise of the private wealth space, where they've become a lot more sophisticated in the way they put together model portfolios and design mandates. Now, Franklin Templeton has a lot of different strategies across equities, fixed income, and alternatives. What are some of your observations, and has the way you engage with the market changed over the years because of these developments?
Yeah, and look, Ruta, you're absolutely right. I mean, over the 10 years that I've been in Australia, the market has developed incredibly. It looks very different today to what it did 10 years ago when I arrived. And I think one of the key, as you point out, key changes is, clearly the consolidation of the superannuation funds, but also the rise of the wealth market. And I think that's been really interesting to observe. We actually made some changes pretty early on as we saw that space evolving and, again, coming to kind of flattening structures. We kind of recognised that the strategies we were talking to institutional clients about, the strategies that they were after, were quite similar to what the private wealth groups, as they started to grow, were looking after. But private wealth had traditionally kind of fallen into the retail segment. So the way that, you know, teams are generally segregated between retail and institutional, those wealth groups were tended to have been serviced by the retail team, who were traditionally selling funds rather than strategies and solutions. So we actually flattened out our structure and kind of, you know, took out heads of the two sides, institutional and retail, put everything together so that there'd be much more fluidity between the teams in terms of the strategies that institutional were talking about that could then be relayed into wealth. But clearly there's still a number of limitations in that space that are applicable to retail in terms of structuring. So there's, you know, there's not the same level of flexibility as you have on institutional. But the whole, there's just, you know, considerable more, you can see my hands, Wouter, the audience can't, but more fluidity, I guess, between the segments than there certainly used to be. And of course, we've seen it with personnel, and it's been fantastic to watch some, you know, exceptional, you know, seasoned institutional investors come into that wealth space and really change the quality and make that a much more institutionalized space. And the other part, which I did touch on before, but is consultants. So particularly in the, not so necessarily so much the private wealth, but into the retail market. So we call them boutique consultants. These consultants, which have really all kind of grown up in the last 5 or 6 years, some have been hugely successful. And again, they've been taking talent from the institutional allocators and putting them into their businesses. And again, they are institutionalizing the investment decision-making of previously IFAs or, you know, smaller kind of individual advisors. So again, that's another big segment that is much more institutionalized than it used to be. So I think there's just a lot more fluidity between the different areas. And I think, again, having a team that is able to understand those different segments and work together across those segments is incredibly important.
Yeah. How do you manage that transition?
It was a bit back to the old days of, right, how do I need to learn this? And actually, this is when mentors came in. People that I knew had worked on that side of the industry and perhaps even, you know, retired now. And I remember sitting down and going through, right, how does the structure work with a platform, with the fund, the rating agencies, who are the different rating agencies, what does this consultant mean, what does the managed account mean, you know, trying to figure out the big financial services groups. So working out what it all means, how it all fits together, and really keeping on asking lots and lots of questions. And when something doesn't quite click or doesn't make sense, keep on going back to it, keep on asking different people. So again, really, you can't research this stuff either. So this wouldn't be a kind of Investopedia.
Can't Google it.
This is not a Google. This is asking people and not being afraid to ask people. So I think once you then get the lay of the land, then it's much easier to then kind of construct the team and think about where skills lie within the team. And, you know, what skills you need from the from different parts of the institutional team and the retail team to kind of service, you know, some of the, you know, the wealth groups that are kind of quasi-insto but still a little bit retail.
Yeah. So what are some of the key projects on your agenda going forward? What are some of your main concerns or opportunities that you see in the market?
Yeah, so key projects, I guess, for us this year, we are really trying to focus a little bit more on community. We admittedly haven't done a great job of giving back to our community. So we're really focusing on that as one of our key strategic pillars. So whether it's getting more involved with community projects, donations, just being participants, thinking about how we can use our skills to help others in the community, that's a key part for our team. I'll get onto the business stuff in a minute, but this is really important for us as a team. We're really trying to have a year of fitness, so we're really trying to do more, encourage each other. So we've signed up for a number of challenges across Sydney and Melbourne. We're trying to just think of little ways to encourage everyone, really for, you know, really for our mental health more than anything else. It's not really a competitive reason for getting in, but just being, you know, more conscious of our movement and more conscious of us taking segments out of our days to ensure that we're actually, you know, spending some time in nature or, you know, just exerting our heartbeat. So those are kind of two critical things as a team. I guess on the business side, we made an acquisition earlier this year of Putnam Investments. So we're currently integrating that group into the organization. We've picked up some clients, institutional clients here in Australia. So critical for us to bed those relationships in. We're also, you know, continuing to focus on our key segments, which are alternatives. That's what our clients are asking us for. So we've got so many different alternatives to draw on. We've got to be really thoughtful about which portfolio managers, which strategies we are focusing on. So we're putting a lot of attention into which exact segments and who we bring to market, and how we position those different investment groups. That's pretty critical for us. Retirement's obviously front of mind, but not something we think we're going to solve. It's more of a let's make sure that we're in the loop on the discussions and thinking about how a large fund manager like us that is not an insurer could potentially play a role in what the retirement income covenant means for superannuation. And similarly, the quality of advice review, it's a pretty critical change, and what that potentially is going to mean for advice and advice within super, for example. This, you know, solutions from a group like us are probably going to go outside of our wheelhouse of traditional investment solutions. So thinking about whether there's ways that we can partner with technology solutions, digital solutions. And really, for me, that's about drawing on some of the things we've done in the US, how we've worked there with kind of technology solutions to help advisors, particularly on the kind of lower end of advice, you know, make their businesses a bit more efficient. So just trying to think about how some of these legislative changes might really impact the market and how we can position ourselves outside of our normal realm. So I think it's a little bit about thinking more broadly than a very traditional...
than just investments.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've got plenty on your agenda to do. Felicity, thank you very much for coming in today and for this conversation. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you very much, Wouter. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the i3 podcast. For more information, please visit www.i3-invest.com. Thank you very much.